All right, welcome to Module 2 of the Bridge Micro Course on Qualitative Research. This module will focus on classic types of qualitative designs. I'm your instructor, Brenna Bray. I have a PhD in biomedical science and neuroscience and postdoctorate training in complementary and integrative health that really centered around qualitative research. My training was through the Bridge R90 T90 program. I was an R90 fellow, and this course is also developed for that Bridge program. Its development is supported by an NCCIH grant. In this module, we're going to talk about classic types of qualitative research design. So, we're going to focus on phenomenology, grounded theory, narrative inquiry, ethnography, and case studies. We're going to use section 2 of chapter 7 in Barrio-Mitten and Linz's 2019 text, Practical Approaches to Applied Research and Program Evaluation for Helping Professionals. We're also going to kind of use pages 6 to 16 of LIMS 2024 text, What is Qualitative Research? And table 4 in that text. There will be an exam at the end of this module. It will have just 3 questions, so it'll be worth 6 points. And by the end of this module, you should be able to articulate key features, uses, strengths, limitations, and resource needs of different types of qualitative research designs. So again, the quiz at the end of this module will be worth just 6 points, so 6% of your overall grade. You'll get an unlimited number of attempts to take that quiz, and you will need an 80% or greater to pass that quiz and this module. So here are the different types of qualitative research design we're going to talk about: phenomenological research, grounded theory research, narrative research, ethnographic research, and case studies. Let's start with phenomenology. In phenomenology, there's an emphasis on meaning making that's related to the lived experiences of a certain subset of individuals. And we're really trying to distill these experiences to an essence, right? So a phenomenon. The primary data source used for phenomenology is in-depth interviews. Usually, participants share an experience of common events or phenomenon. So, an example in kind of the media might be Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, which really describes a shared lived experience of life in a concentration camp. A more upbeat example might be Disney Pixar's movie Inside Out, which explores Riley's lived internal emotional experience of change, growth, and emotion. So, really seeking to make meaning of that experience and understand that experience as a phenomenon and as a shared experience, right, with common events and phenomenon that a lot of folks can identify with. A third example would be Max van Manen's Phenomenology of Practice, which explores lived experiences, including healthcare and education settings, so a little bit more relevant to this kind of course. Phenomenology, again, uses in-depth interviews with participants who have experienced common events or phenomenon. It seeks to uncover individual experiences and meaning-making and processes really in-depth. It works across cases, usually, so multiple in-depth interviews to uncover shared elements of these experiences. So it really seeks to understand the phenomenology. And in the text Phenomenology of Practice, they're really seeking to give meaning. So it's meaning-giving methods, as the subtext here, meaning-given methods in phenomenological research and writing. So here's a little schematic. This is figure 3 in LIMS 2024 text on phenomenology. And it's showing that it's informed through personal reflexivity from findings. So phenomenology, we're really focusing on understanding lived experiences. So here we might have our experiences, and we're discerning kind of experiences from things, right? So our experiences might include emotion, which we might describe as excitement or disappointment in a product, and thought, considering the benefits and costs of a product. Memory, which we might describe as nostalgia of past experiences with a brand, and imagination, envisioning using a product in daily life. And desire, which we might describe as aspiring to own a luxury product, and volition, deciding to purchase a particular product. And then things will discern. We might describe body awareness, so feeling comfortable or uncomfortable when using a product, embodied action, so ease or ways of using a product, social activity, using a product with others, and others, so events, interactions, objects, time, self, and people. And then we bring our own consciousness to these experiences and things. So that enables con enabling conditions might include bodily gestures, cultural or historical context, embodiment, tangible or visual expression or representation, language, social practices, etc. So here we might focus on awareness, on knowing something, be it an experience or things, qualia, so the subjective property that's unique to each person's conscious experience. We might ask what kind or what sort of awareness or experience we're observing. We're going to bring intentionality, so the directness of experience towards things in the world. So it is always an experience or something. And then we're bringing meaning, so the significance of things as they arise and experienced in our life world, and the significance of that experience, which can be distinct from things. So a contemplative Buddhist approach, which often will also use qualitative research, we might observe these experiences and these things in the real world, and we're trying to connect our own awareness, our own consciousness, our own qualia, our own intentionality and meaning to these experiences and things, right? But rather than applying our own awareness, we're really trying to receive the awareness, the qualia, the meaning, the intentionality that is there in those things that we're observing. So when we are the observer, we try to remove our own awareness, our own quality, and really seek to understand the awareness that's there. Next, we're going to move on to grounded theory. So grounded theory is another kind of main type of qualitative research. It focuses on developing a theory directly from data through iterative or repetitive processes of coding, analysis, and comparison. So it's a more quantitative type of qualitative analysis. The emphasis here is on using data to build a substantive theory about a process or phenomenon. The primary data source here is going to be semi-structured interviews, but this research type may also include observations or document reviews. As I said, it tends to be a more quantitative type of qualitative analysis. An example of grounded theory might be the TV show Undercover Boss, which kind of loosely uses grounded theory principles. So in that TV show, an executive works incognito in their company, experiencing daily operations from an employee's perspective. So a high-level executive pretends to be kind of a lower-level employee or a, regular employee. They're working incognito undercover to really understand what is the daily experience of their employees from their employees' perspectives. It loosely follows grounded theory principles. So the executive gathers firsthand observations, identifies patterns in employee experiences, and develops policies or changes based on insight. And that's one thing I really want to focus on here with grounded theory. It's really commonly used to identify a theory that can be used to develop or inform policy changes or policy development. Another example of grounded theory would be Glasser and Strauss's text, Awareness of Dying. They use grounded theory to develop a framework about how medical staff manage and communicate with terminally ill patients. Insights emerge directly from observing these interactions, as well as interviewing patients, nurses, and doctors, and it really captures the reality of their interactions. In grounded theory, semi-structured interviews are used to build a substantive theory about a process or a phenomenon. We use constant comparative analysis to understand units of meaning within and across cases. So, this piece, this identifying and understanding units of meaning, is central and core to qualitative analysis, almost all qualitative analysis processes. And this is kind of how we start to kind of quantify our qualitative work. and develop operational definitions, right? By identifying these units of meaning that occur across cases and within cases. We then identify categories or themes, so groups of units, to create theories that can explain relationships and processes among categories and themes. And we'll get into this a lot more in Module 4. The next type of qualitative design I want to address is narrative inquiry. With narrative inquiry, the emphasis is on using stories to illustrate meaning and experiences. The primary data sources used in narrative inquiry are often oral or written word. So we primarily use semi-structured interviews, but we might incorporate experiences conveyed in autobiographical writings and other documents. A good example of this would be Humans of New York, either the main text or the Humans of New York stories. This is Brandon Stanton's work. This is a widely known project. It seeks to understand everyday individuals' experiences through everyday individuals in New York. So New Yorkers share their personal stories through interviews and photographs. It embodies narrative inquiry principles, so it focuses on lived experiences and reveals universal themes of humanity, resilience, and connection. It uses, so with narrative inquiry broadly, we tend to use semi-structured interviews to illustrate meaning and experience. And there are three kind of main processes in narrative inquiry. We collect stories and experiences, we analyze them for themes, and then we construct a common shared story. Next, we're going to move on to ethnography. Ethnography is another pretty common type of qualitative research. It's used to understand cultural groups or phenomenon, uncover greater cultural meaning, and it usually involves prolonged immersion, observation, and engagement in a site or in a culture. And by prolonged, we really are talking about months to years. So I'll just kind of go back here. A very common example of ethnography would be Jane Goodall's work in primates, so primatological ethnography. Ethnography focuses on understanding cultural groups or phenomenon. The primary data source are usually observations of individuals and interactions. So with other research types that we've discussed, grounded theory, usually semi-structured interviews are kind of the primary source of data, as well as same with phenomenology. In narrative inquiry, we also kind of use stories. In ethnography, we really use observations and individuals and interactions. We might also include artifacts, so this might include photographs, documents, everyday items, and then we do also include interviews with community members. Again, a good example would be Jane Goodall's primatological ethnography, which was a decades-long immersion with chimpanzees in Tanzania. This uses key ethnographic principles, so prolonged engagement, deep observation, and an ability to interpret behaviors within cultural and social contexts, right? So we spend a long time immersing in a culture, really understanding, observing the culture, and that can enable us to interpret behaviors or phenomenon within that cultural context. And then the last type of qualitative design that we'll cover here are case studies. And I want to make a point that case studies don't have to be qualitative, they can be quantitative as well, but they are a common form of qualitative data collection and analysis. In case studies, the emphasis is on understanding one thing well, often from multiple perspectives. So that one thing might be a phenomenon or a pathology or a program or a unit. Our unit of analysis here usually is a bounded system. So an individual or a program or an organization in its own context. And here I've got one example of a case study that might be more well known is that of David Vetter, who had severe combined immunodeficiency disorder. His case was widely published and turned into a movie, which I think was titled The Boy in the Bubble with John Travolta. So here we go, Danny Vetter, The Boy in the Bubble. which was a very common case study in science, focused on the real life experience of severe combined immunodeficiency disorder, or SCID. It's a rare genetic disorder resulting in no effective immune system, requiring a sterile living environment. So for this individual, they kind of created this bubble, which you can see here. This case gave us insights into medical, psychological, and ethical aspects of living with SCID. So again, this is a very holistic approach, right? We're not just understanding the medical experience, we're not just understanding the psychological experience, we're not just understanding the ethical experience, we're looking at all of these experiences together. It made significant contributions to medical advancements in SCID standard of care, so bone marrow transplant and gene therapy. And it helped ask ethical questions about experimental treatment, quality of life, and the limits of ethical medical intervention. There's no really primary data source in a case study, right? We're just looking at this one case. Usually, we use multiple data sources that are triangulated within the bounded case. So we don't focus on any one source of data. For example, the case study of SCID might conduct observations, review of medical records, interview of the patient, the parents, experts in ethics, science, medicine, and psychology. We might incorporate quantitative data, as I mentioned, especially with case studies. And usually the focus is on using multiple data sources to describe a case and central themes. So here's an example of a case study in research. This is Kimberly Middleton's 2015 publication, Yoga Research and Spirituality, a Case Study Discussion. So they say in their abstract, there's a growing evidence that yoga can be beneficial as an aspect of self-care for people with arthritis. However, yoga may be less acceptable to those from different cultures, socioeconomic backgrounds, and racial or ethnic identities. While implementing a feasibility and acceptability pilot study of yoga as self-care in minority communities, the subject of spirituality surfaced. This commentary shares the experience of the researchers and yoga teachers collaborating on the study and the larger conversation that ensued following the withdrawal of one of the study participants. It is an attempt to start a relevant and needed dialogue around yoga research as an integrative health modality, and why the underlying body, mind, spirit approach to yoga may sometimes serve as a barrier to participation for diverse populations suffering from arthritis. So, in this publication, you can see it's a case study, and they kind of report the case. A 59-year-old Spanish-speaking Hispanic female from El Salvador enrolled in a rheumatology natural history study. She was referred to the yoga study after completing a clinical visit. She self-identified as Catholic and was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis. After completing all baseline questionnaires and physical assessments, she attended the first yoga class. She returned to the second class to say she would not be returning for religious reasons and left her equipment. She called later to say the yoga studio made her uncomfortable and she thought the teacher's beliefs were being imposed on her. She specifically did not like doing yoga in front of a statue, Patanjali, that seemed, quote, diabolic. She went on to explain that she thought it was going to be something different and did not feel the yoga would help her. This experience, the researchers say, caused us to retrace our steps. Prior to obtaining IRB clearance, instructions were given to remove, quote, spiritual aspects of yoga from the clinical trial. It was not immediately clear which would be considered cultural versus spiritual practices. The decision was ultimately made that no music would be played, there would be no chanting om or bowing to say namaste, and the Sanskrit names for yoga poses would not be used. Still, there was a desire on the part of the researchers to stay true to a basic yoga philosophy and not become a low-impact stretching exercise class. However, some questions surfaced after this experience. Was it naive to think that by removing all spiritual aspects of yoga, we could keep it from bumping up against anyone's religious beliefs? How could we ensure that while yoga is not a religion, it still allows room for spiritual experiences should they emerge? We were offered space in a Kundalini studio after attempts to rent other studios accessible to all participants. The question surfaced, is there a culture that comes from being in some yoga studios as opposed to a gym or other spaces? Should we cover the statue, or would that suggest there was something inappropriate about it? If asked, we would explain any of the statues or pictures specifically that Patanjali is an influential figure with some yoga traditions, and he is not a god or a deity. Was it better to discuss concerns if they arose, or preemptively as a studio orientation? When considering the mind-body connection, the mind component is not only about mental health, but also includes spirituality. Not addressing spirituality may miss a vital component that contributes to overall well-being. To help ground our discussion, we sought a definition of spirituality within the realm of clinical research. And this publication goes on, but it really starts with one case, right? And the point that I want to make here with case studies are often case studies can help us identify a seed that can bloom and grow into a greater understanding. So, in this one case, one participant in their study raised concerns about the kind of aspects of spirituality and perhaps a discernment of spirituality as opposed to religiosity, and how that might impact them in the context of mind-body interventions in yoga specifically. So, this one case was really explored in greater depth to help identify a need for a greater explanation. So, this is a great example of where qualitative research can identify needs, process evaluations, and participant satisfaction through the context of a case study. And that closes this module. After this, you will take your module exam. You'll need an 80% or greater to pass. You have an unlimited number of attempts at that exam, and then we'll move on to module three. Oh, sorry, module two.